From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
To defend our values and our way of life is greater than their determination to cause death and destruction to innocent people in a desire to impose extremism on the world.
Prime Minister Tony Blair at the G8 conference today responding to the series of explosions in London. Then a conversation with New York Times op-ed columnist Bob Herbert about the jailing of his Times colleague Judith Miller and on his book, Promises Betrayed, Waking from the American Dream. Then part two of our conversation on the Gitmo experiment, how methods developed by the U.S. military for withstanding torture are being used against detainees at Guantanamo Bay. We'll speak with New Yorker reporter Jane Mayer. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here are the headlines. A series of bomb blasts ripped through the London subway system during rush hour this morning. As many as seven separate blasts have been reported. At least one double-decker bus was also reportedly blown up, with witnesses describing it like a can of sardines being ripped open. Details remain very vague, but officials are saying many people have died and scores more have been injured. As people emerge from the underground, they described what happened.
I thought we'd hit another train. I thought we'd seriously gone into another train, and that was exactly what I thought until they took us off the train and walked us up the side of the train. And then you could see it then. I mean, whatever it was, that come from inside out, like, you know, just peeled a big hole off the top of the roof, and there was bits of the train scattered all over the tracks. You know, dead bodies lay by the side of the tracks. It's terrible. Terrible day.
An eyewitness describing the scene in a London underground after today's explosion. Police officials say there was evidence of explosives at least one of the six sites. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has left the G8 summit in Scotland and headed back to London. Before leaving, he addressed the world media.
Just as it is reasonably clear that this is a terrorist attack or a series of terrorist attacks, it's also reasonably clear that it is designed and aimed to coincide with the opening of the G8. There will be time to talk later about this. It's important, however, that those engaged in terrorism realize that our determination to defend our values and our way of life is greater than their determination to cause death and destruction to innocent people in a desire to impose extremism on the world.
That was Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking this morning before leaving Scotland. Meanwhile, a senior Israeli official has been widely quoted today as saying British police told the Israeli embassy in London minutes before today's explosions they'd received warnings of possible terror attacks in the city. Israel was holding an economic conference near the scene of one of the explosions. Israeli Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was supposed to attend, but the attacks occurred before he arrived. The official says that just before the blast, Scotland Yard called the security officer at the Israeli embassy and said warnings of possible attacks had been received. We'll have more on the explosions in a moment. Back in this country, a U.S. district judge ordered New York Times reporter Judith Miller jailed yesterday for refusing to reveal her confidential sources to a special prosecutor investigating who in the Bush administration leaked a covert CIA officer's identity. Miller spent last night in the same prison facility that houses accused terror suspect Zacharias Moussaoui. Matt Cooper of Time magazine avoided to jail after what he described as a stunning set of developments, telling the court he had changed his mind and would cooperate after the source he protected for 2 years released him from his promise of confidentiality. His source came forward after Time Inc. turned over his notes and emails last week over Cooper's objections, effectively giving away the source's identity. Cooper said, quote, "A short time ago, in somewhat dramatic fashion, I received an express personal release from my source." Since the beginning of the scandal, the top suspect in many eyes has been President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove. Today, the New York Times quotes a source the paper says has been officially briefed on the case as saying that Matt Cooper's source was indeed Karl Rove. This detail is buried in the 24th paragraph of the Times lead story. The paper says Cooper's decision to drop his refusal to testify followed discussions on Wednesday morning among lawyers representing Cooper and Rove. The independent prosecutor, Peter Fitzgerald, was reportedly also involved in the discussions. Meanwhile, Ambassador Joe Wilson, whose wife Valerie Plame was exposed as the undercover CIA operative, issued a statement last night saying, quote, "The conspiracy to cover up the web of lies that underpinned the invasion of Iraq is more important to the White House than coming clean on a serious breach of national security. Thus has Ms. Miller joined my wife, Valerie, and her 20 years of service to this nation as collateral damage in the smear campaign launched when I had the temerity to challenge the president on his assertion that Iraq had attempted to purchase uranium yellow cake from Africa." Wilson continued, "The real victims of this cover-up, which may have turned criminal, are the Congress, the Constitution, and most tragically, the Americans and Iraqis who have paid the ultimate price for Bush's folly." We'll have more on these developments later in the program. More than 100 members of the Iraqi parliament are now officially calling for the U.S. to withdraw its troops from Iraq. They're demanding that the National Assembly adopt a resolution canceling the request made by the Iraqi government to the U.N. Security Council to extend the presence of multinational forces. They also call on the government to set a timetable for withdrawal. The U.S. Army has ordered nearly $5 billion in work from the Halliburton Corporation in Iraq over the next year. That's $1 billion above what the Army paid for similar services the previous year. The new order comes despite serious questions about the company's past billing practices. Last week, the Pentagon confirmed a report by congressional Democrats saying that the Defense Contract Audit Agency has questioned more than $1 billion of Halliburton's bills for work in Iraq. Among the costs that Pentagon auditors questioned were more than $150,000 for movie rentals, $1.5 million for tailoring, and two multi-million-dollar transportation bills that appear to overlap. Meanwhile, the Army announced this week it's buying 16 tactical blimps to use in Iraq. The cost of the unmanned tethered blimps is estimated at $12 million. The blimps are part of a contract the Army has with Raytheon Corporation. The airship's use was demonstrated last fall over Washington when an A-170 manned blimp hovered over the city for 24 hours. Blimps have also recently been used to monitor protests such as the demonstrations against the Republican National Convention in New York last year. The Pentagon admitted Wednesday that the U.S. military is holding at least 5 U.S. citizens among more than 10,000 prisoners in Iraq. All of the 5 are being held without charge or access to lawyers. They're all being held on loose suspicion of being linked to the Iraqi resistance. The Pentagon refuses to identify the 5, but the New York Times and Los Angeles Times have identified one as 44-year-old Cyrus Carr, an aspiring filmmaker from Los Angeles who was arrested in Iraq in May. An ACLU spokesperson said Carr has been held virtually incommunicado for more than 50 days and called his detention, quote, illegal, unconstitutional, and inhumane. The Chronicle of Higher Education is reporting that the Republican chair of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce is investigating 3 professors whose work suggests that the Earth's climate is warmer now than at any time in many centuries and that increasing levels of greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels are largely to blame. In letters to the three scientists last week, Congressmember Joe Barton of Texas demanded detailed documentation about the hundreds of studies on which they were an author or co-author. Barton also sent a letter to the director of the National Science Foundation that requests information about the work of the three professors, as well as a list of all grants and awards in the area of climate and paleoclimate science, which number 2,700 in the past 10 years. The investigation focuses on studies by Michael Mann, an assistant professor of environmental science at the University of Virginia, Raymond Bradley, a professor of geosciences at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Malcolm Hughes, a professor in the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research of the University of Arizona. Congressmember Barton worked in the oil and gas industry before being elected to Congress in 1984. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, he's consistently ranked as one of the top five recipients of campaign contributions from that industry over the past decade. A court of appeals in Chile has stripped ailing ex-dictator General Augusto Pinochet of his immunity in a case involving political prisoners killed during his iron-fisted rule. The case alleges Pinochet's involvement in the abduction and killing of political prisoners during what his intelligence services dubbed Operation Columbo. Meanwhile, a Peruvian judge has ordered the arrest of 118 soldiers for their alleged involvement in the massacre of peasants in an Andean village in 1988. The judge issued the order in connection with the torture and killing of more than two dozen people. Bolivia's interim president, Eduardo Rodriguez, announced yesterday he scheduled presidential elections for December 4th. This followed weeks of indigenous-led revolt that brought down President Carlos Mesa. A delegation of right-wing talk radio hosts is headed to Iraq this month on a mission to report what they call the truth about the war. American troops are winning despite headlines to the contrary. They're calling it the Truth Tour, and they'll be broadcasting from the occupation's headquarters in Baghdad's Green Zone. One of the U.S. radio hosts, Mark Williams from KFBK in Sacramento, told Fox News, quote, "We are Americans first and journalists second, as opposed to the crop of pinkos that tell us on the news every night that America is going to hell in a handbasket." And President Bush has had another accident on his bicycle. He collided with a local police officer in Scotland and fell during a bike ride on the grounds of the Glen Eagles Golf Resort while attending the G8 summit. Bush suffered scrapes on his hands and arms that required bandages by the White House physician. The police officer suffered an ankle injury.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers. Many people were injured and several were believed dead after a series of at least six explosions in London around 9 this morning. Near simultaneous explosions occurred on at least three buses and several subway trains. Authorities are calling the blast a major incident. All subway and bus service has been halted. A train passenger who identified himself as Angelo Power described his experience during the blast.
People started to scream because it was a burning smell, and everyone, to cut a long story short, thought they were going to die. People started saying prayers, praying to God, panicking, breaking the carriage windows with their bare hands, anything to get oxygen into the carriage, because more people tried, the more distressed they became, women passing out, people started getting very agitated, there was no communication from any drivers, everyone was in pitch black, then the emergency lights came on, And more smoke started coming into the carriage, and we were there for something like 20 to 30 minutes, during which the smoke intensified, the screaming intensified, the hysteria, and that's what it was, became almost to a state of pandemonium. And then eventually somebody said that someone at the back of the carriage, because I was on the second to the back carriage, that had managed to force the door open, but they wouldn't get up because they thought they were going to be electrocuted by the live train lines. Then the smoke was coming down the tunnel, so nobody would go out of that exit. No one would go out of the other exit because, as I understand it, there's a bomb in the middle of the carriage. So we were all trapped like sardines waiting to die, and I honestly thought my time was up. But as did everyone else. And finally, after about 30 minutes or so, people started to leave the carriage, and to the credit, in a very controlled manner. But as I exited, I saw people's belongings scattered all over the place. People were physically injured. The carriage's windows were all smashed. There were no emergency people on hand to escort anyone off the train, save for two officers who had arrived 30 minutes or so. But the question I ask is, why was the train allowed to proceed from Manor House when they knew, or must have known, that these things were going on? And it's just almost negligent.
And what did you see of the medical operation that's unfolding down there?
There was none at first, because everyone said it was a technical failure, and it wasn't. You know, there was just mass communication failure. And given what's passed before in Madrid, I'm really at a loss to say why this was. It was clear from people who were exiting what had happened. There were emergency services there, but I think, in hindsight, which is always a great factor, that things could have been done a lot better, perhaps. But I can't say really any more than that, except, you know, I should probably tell I'm shocked myself.
You're shocked. I can see that your skin has been discoloured by the blackness of the smoke, and your lips, in some respects, are a lucky escape for you. What about the others that you saw?
The others I saw had physical injuries. Some had marks to the face where the carriage windows had punctured the skin. Others were physically lying on the floor because they basically suffered smoke inhalation. But others in the main carriages, I understand, are severely injured, if not dead. You know? So, but at the end of the day, I honestly thought I was going to die. You know? I'm just grateful to be alive.
It is looking increasingly as though this is a concerted terror attack. What do you think about the people behind this, having lived through this nightmare yourself today?
Well, as a barrister, all I can say is, you know, I wait for the evidence before I can make any or jump to any conclusions as to who it may be. But all I can say is, you know, whoever is responsible for it, you know, I take pity on them. You know.
Pity?
Yeah, pity. Because whoever has perpetrated such a wicked act, you know, needs pity, really.
That was train passenger Angelo Power, a London barrister caught up in the attacks this morning. British Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke several hours after the explosions from the G8 summit in Scotland.
It's reasonably clear that there have been a series of terrorist attacks in London. There are obviously casualties, both people that have died and people seriously injured. And our thoughts and prayers, of course, are with the victims and their families. It's my intention to leave the G8 within the next couple of hours and go down to London and get a report face-to-face with the police and the emergency services and the ministers that have been dealing with this, and then to return later this evening. It is the will of all the leaders at the G8, however, that the meeting should continue in my absence, that we should continue to discuss the issues that we were going to discuss, and reach the conclusions which we were going to reach. Each of the countries around that table has some experience of the effects of terrorism, and all the leaders, as they will indicate a little bit later, share our complete resolution to defeat this terrorism. It's particularly barbaric that this has happened on a day when people are meeting to try to help the problems of poverty in Africa and the long-term problems of climate change and the environment. Just as it is reasonably clear that this is a terrorist attack or a series of terrorist attacks, it's also reasonably clear that it is designed and aimed to coincide with the opening of the G8. There will be time to talk later about this. It's important, however, that those engaged in terrorism realize that our determination to defend our values and our way of life is greater than their determination to cause death and destruction to innocent people in a desire to impose extremism on the world. Whatever they do, it is our determination that they will never succeed in destroying what we hold dear in this country and in other civilized nations throughout the world.
That was British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking from the G8 summit at the Glen Eagles Resort in Scotland. He was speaking following a series of explosions on London trains and buses. As we turn now to another witness, Loita Worley in London.
There was just a big bang, and all the lights went, and then ash started falling, and it was a smell of burning and everything in the carriage. And some people panicked, and some people, you know, most people kept calm. Couldn't move anywhere because it's rush hour, everybody standing on the train. We heard people shouting for help.
How did you feel?
I'm quite a calm kind of person, so I was okay. My main fear was I didn't know what it was, so I was wondering if there's a fire. I did think that if there's a fire, then that was probably going to be it, really. But, you know, there's nothing we could do about it because we couldn't move anywhere. We were just stuck. They called for medics, and they said that some people in one of the other carriages were pretty badly hurt.
And did you see anyone yourself?
Not at that point, but we had to walk down the track past the wreckage, so at that point...
Say wreckage. What sort of wreckage?
At that point, I think assumed it was a bomb because it looked like it had blown from the inside out.
How bad was that damage?
It looked pretty. It was extensive. There was wreckage on the track. Whether the rescuers had pulled the side off, I don't know, because one side of the tube was on the track.
So a whole side of a carriage had gone.
Well, no, but a large panel of the side of the carriage, and they were bringing people out who just, you know, were naked. They were black, but alive. But
with covered in blood.
Their clothes had all been blown off, and they were just black.
And how quickly were the emergency services there?
I think probably, I don't know, 10 minutes or so. Everybody was trying to pull the alarm cords, but they'd already been triggered. And that's the worst thing, because you don't know. I presume that the lads, you know, the communication line with the driver had gone as well, because we just didn't know what had happened or what was happening. But people were really good, actually. People stationed themselves at the door to stop stampedes. And people, one man went from the very back carriage, the carriage where it happened, and everybody made way for him to go up to the driver and try and get help as soon as possible, because there were some very badly injured people.
Can you guess how many people were hurt in this?
I don't know, because I think some of them must have been taken off before we walked past the carriage, but there was certainly, I saw at least one body lying on the floor of the carriage.
Somebody injured or?
They weren't trying to treat them. I don't know whether they were injured or dead. I don't know.
What happened after that?
Eventually, we managed to get through to the front, it wasn't the back, but the driver's carriage, and they got us down onto the track. But then, as I say, we had to walk up the track, past the damage, up to Aldgate, where they took us, they siphoned us off then. They were all there then, they were brilliant then. They took us over to the area by the bus garage, and they had some double-decker buses, and they treated the seriously wounded in the buses. They took everybody's names, and
So where were you when this happened?
It was between Liverpool Street and Aldgate in the tunnel.
And how far did you have to walk? Was it a long walk to Aldgate?
No, I mean, that was the best thing, is because when you got out of the train, you could actually see the lights at Aldgate Tube Station, because, I mean, a lot of people, I think, found that the walking along the tunnel... Well, I mean, everybody's in shock, you know, walking along the tunnel and seeing the devastation and knowing that therefore, but for the grace of God, go you, it was a trauma in itself, really. So I'm just saying, you know, just keep going, keep looking, and we're okay.
Loita Worley is a witness to the explosions this morning in London. We go to break. When we come back, we'll go directly to London to speak with independent journalist and student Omar Araich. We'll also be joined by longtime British parliamentarian Tony Benn. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On the line with us from Britain is former longtime British parliamentarian Tony Benn, MP Tony Benn, who joins us now as we talk about these developments in London, the latest, the series of explosions that took place in the underground, in the subways, as well as on buses. Can you talk about where you are, Tony Benn, and your reaction?
I was doing a television interview when my daughter rang and said, "Are you safe?" And I didn't know what she meant. And I turned on the television and heard as I rang all my children. One of them is a minister on his way to Glen Eagles, and others are safe. And everyone's ringing everyone else to find out if they're safe. But it is something long expected, and the casualties at the moment are minuscule compared to what happened in 9/11 or what happened in Fallujah. But they're all casualties of the war.
You know, as we watch this in the United States unfold, the British press early in the morning, very careful not to use the word terrorism,
yes,
saying possibly a power surge, the British police getting on and saying there has been a major incident. Really, it was only when Tony Blair spoke from the G8 summit where he identified this as an act of international terrorism.
Yes, well, undoubtedly, that is what it was. I mean, I heard the news at the moment you describe when they said it was just a bit of problems here and there. But it has been a very carefully planned attack to correspond with Glen Eagles, maybe just after London wins the Olympics as well. But it would have been planned for a long time. And, of course, the response we're getting from the Prime Minister is exactly like the President's speech the other day to the soldiers he addressed. We'll never resist, we'll never give way, we've got to win. But the trouble is, when you think about it, you realize that hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, well, over 100,000 as a result of this war. And at some stage, you have to ask yourself, how can we end the violence? It's not the terrorism, just it's the violence, because terrorism and bombing are the same. The suicide bomber and the stealth bomber both kill innocent people for political purposes, and you have to turn your mind to how you deal with this.
Now, also, as you're probably aware, we've gotten reports that a senior Israeli official has been quoted widely as saying that the British police told the Israeli embassy in London minutes before today's explosions that they had received warnings of possible terror attacks in the city. Any more news that you've been hearing about that allegation?
No, I haven't. But, I mean, London has been on a high alert since 9/11 because the commissioner of the police in London did say some time ago, and everybody understood it, London is a target. And after Madrid, Of course, we thought of ourselves as the principal ally of the United States in the Iraq War as an obvious target, and this has been carefully planned. What's so interesting about it is a very low-level attack, if you know what I mean, in technological terms. It's not like the complexity of 9/11, where the planes were people were trained to fly and all the rest of it. This is just the suicide bombing of the kind that you read about every day in the Middle East, all over the world.
Tony Benn, we're also joined by an independent journalist and student in London, Omar Warraich. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Omar.
Thank you, Amy.
Where were you at the time of the blast, and what do you understand at this point? What are you seeing around you?
Well, I was at home. I was about to make my way towards central London, and then I started receiving phone calls, as Mr. Benn did himself, from friends and family asking if I was okay. I quickly went back and switched on the news. You see a spate of bombing throughout the center of London. It affecting key areas. There's one that was a train on the way from Aldgate East to Liverpool Street, which is the financial district. Then there was there were explosions that took place in Bloomsbury, which is sort of considered, it's also the heart of London, also the intellectual heart of London, where the British Museum is located, several universities and so forth. And now we have reports that on a bus that was torn apart, people are saying that perhaps it was a suicide bomb that was on that bus. And then, oddly enough, there was another explosion at Edgware Road Station, which is a heavily populated Arab area of London, within the center of London. That has caused great concern. At the moment, mobile phone lines are jammed everywhere. People are trying to make sense of the situation. The Home Secretary, Charles Clarke, has just addressed Parliament, confirmed that there have been four explosions thus far. And the Conservatives and everyone has condemned these attacks so far. They have said it's a terrorist attack, but they haven't apportioned blame to anyone yet.
And in terms, there's no indication yet that there's any possibility of chemical or biological attack, which would obviously be the even much bigger concern and potential catastrophic nature of an attack.
No, nothing of that sort has been said. As Mr. Benn stated earlier, first there was a call given out to Alafias saying it was power surges, and then only later, when Charles Clarke made his announcement outside Downing Street that it was a terrorist attack, was that confirmed. Repeated later by Tony Blair, who then took a stand with the rest of the G8 leaders at Gleneagles to reaffirm Mr. Clarke's statement.
Tony Benn, also on the line with us, former British MP with the Labour Party. Here you have Tony Benn making this address from the G8 summit, which he is Tony Blair, which he is presiding over. He will leave there, and then he says, go back. He says, no matter what, this meeting will not be derailed, as they talk about improving the situation, he said, in Africa and other such issues. Your response?
Yes, well, I mean, the Gleneagles summit has been highlighted because the Prime Minister has made a big issue of climate change in Africa. Everybody's discussed it. We've had big concerts, Bob Geldof, and people have been organizing events to raise awareness. And, of course, the Prime Minister has said, well, Iraq war is behind us, put it behind us, and now people realize it isn't behind us. It's our immediate situation. And I think it will lead to a major rethink, because you remember, if we go back to what happened in Madrid, Aznar was one of the great supporters of the president in the war. And then after the elections, Zapatero came in and withdrew the Spanish troops. And I think in time, though it's much too soon to speak in these terms, but the political consequence of this will be twofold. First of all, there will be tightened security, which means that
Tony Benn, I'm going to interrupt for a minute to get your response to President Bush is speaking right now from Gleneagles, from the G8 summit. Let's just join him live.
We'll not yield to the terrorists. We will find them, we'll bring them to justice, and at the same time, we will spread an ideology of hope and compassion that will overwhelm their ideology of hate. Thank you very much.
You still say that the war is...
President Bush walking away, not taking questions. We'll try to play a little more of it for you in a minute. He just spoke for a few minutes. Tony Benn, your response. You got the gist. We will bring the terrorists to justice.
Well, this is the standard response. I mean, if you go back to whenever you're attacked, if I remember Oh, on Spain, what happened was Zapatero was elected and the Spanish troops were withdrawn from Iraq. And I think there will undoubtedly be, as there now increasingly is in the United States itself, a questioning of the war. And when you're attacked, you always say what the Prime Minister said and Bush said last week. You always say to them that this attack will strengthen our resolve. And in the Blitz in London when I was a 14-year-old, when we were being bombed, Churchill said we will fight them on the beaches and so on. That's what you say when you're under attack. But at the same time, history shows that in the end, where you have a war of this magnitude and the number of casualties all over the place, people are bound to say, well, what is the way out? And it's too early to talk in those terms today because people are so absorbed with the casualties, the tragedies, the deaths, the bereavements. But they will start asking this question, and the hope that the Iraq war could be put behind the Prime Minister has been proved to be absolutely wrong.
Speaking with a longtime British MP, Tony Benn of the Labour Party, former MP. We're also joined in our studio by Bob Herbert, op-ed columnist with the New York Times, has a new book out called Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. But before we go to Bob, let's just play the beginning of what President Bush just said.
This morning I've been in contact with our Homeland Security folks. I instructed them to be in touch with local and state officials about the facts of what took place here in London and to be extra vigilant as our folks start heading to work. You know, the contrast between what we've seen on the TV screens here, what's taking place in London, what's taking place here is incredibly vivid to me. On the one hand, you got people here who are working to alleviate poverty, to help rid the world of the pandemic of AIDS. They're working on ways to have a clean environment. And on the other hand, you got people killing innocent people. And the contrast couldn't be clearer between the intentions and the hearts of those of us who care deeply about human rights and human liberty, and those who kill, those who've got such evil in their heart that they will take the lives of innocent folks. This is the war on terror goes on. I was most impressed by the resolve of all the leaders in the room. Their resolve is as strong as my resolve, and that is we will not yield to these people. We'll not yield to the terrorists. We will find them, we will bring them to justice, and at the same time we will spread an ideology of hope and compassion that will overwhelm their ideology of hate. Thank you very much.
President Bush speaking from Glen Eagles Resort, where the G8 summit is taking place. We're joined by Tony Benn on the phone from Britain, by Bob Herbert, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, in our studio. The latest news we have at the time of this broadcast, two people confirmed dead, more than 100 injured, and the BBC is reporting that an Islamist website claims links to Al-Qaeda says it's behind the attacks. Bob Herbert, your comments on what's happening and the comment of President Bush.
Well, the first thing, of course, is that your hearts go out to the people in London, anybody who went through what we went through here in New York on September 11, 2001, knows how terrifying this can be. You hope that the casualties can be kept as low as possible. The thing that immediately struck me when I was watching this on television this morning was that I have felt ever since September 11th that it's clear that the enemy of the U.S. and its allies are the terrorists, and that we need to have been focused and continue to focus like a laser beam on fighting the scourge of terrorism here and around the world. And you can only do this successfully with alliances. And so what you want to do is build bridges and alliances so that you can provide as much as possible a united front on that. And I'm not sure we've taken the wisest route so far, but this may be yet another wake-up call for us.
And in terms of the impact, obviously here, as you say, for those of us who went through 9-1-1, clearly I think Police Commissioner Ray Kelly was announcing he's going to have an announcement on increased security in the New York subway systems. And after the Madrid attacks and now the London attacks, clearly there is a heightened sense that of the vulnerability of having the biggest subway system here in the world, right here in New York City.
We're extremely vulnerable. I mean, the U.S. is a fundamentally open society, which is another reason why you have to remain so focused on the problem at hand. I mean, you know, what I'm talking about is, you know, foreign adventures that are unnecessary, namely the war in Iraq. You have a subway system in New York City, but all kinds of other vulnerabilities here in the city and around the country. We see what's going on in London today. We saw what happened in Spain. And what I would really like to see is the wisest mind. This should not be a political issue. It should not be a Republican or a Democratic issue. I'd like to see the wisest minds in this country call together to try and find out what would be the best route for us to pursue going ahead. And as I mentioned before, that whatever that route is, it would have to involve extensive diplomacy and alliances with our allies overseas. I have not seen that happening. We're spending $5 billion a month, I guess it is, in this war in Iraq. There's no end in sight, when in fact the real scourge is terrorism.
We're talking to Bob Herbert, a columnist for the New York Times, author of the book Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. Tony Benn also on the line with us, British parliamentarian, former MP in Britain. We're going to break, then we'll be back. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Democracy Now! Broadcasting on 350 radio and television stations around the country. Our apologies to our television listeners. We're having a technical difficulty, and so you're just getting the radio broadcast as well. Thanks for bearing with us. You can also go to our website at democracynow.org for transcripts of today's broadcast, as well as to listen to it. Again, the latest news, a series of bomb blasts ripping through the London subway system today at rush hour, as well as through some buses. The latest news we have, Scotland Yard is saying the explosions occurred at Edgware Road, King's Cross, Liverpool Street, Russell Square, Aldgate East, and Moorgate. That might not have much meaning to people here in the United States, except that the fact that explosions did happen. All the London Underground services and bus services in central London have been indefinitely halted. The BBC is reporting that an Islamist website that claims links to Al-Qaeda says it was behind the attacks. Two people have been confirmed dead, more than 100 injured. We're joined in our studio by New York Times op-ed columnist Bob Herbert, author of the book Promises Betrayed. And on the line with us, Omar Warraish, an independent journalist and student in London, and the former British MP, Tony Benn. Let's get final comments from both of you in Britain as we move on with stories here that may or may not be related, but certainly relate to the war in Iraq. Omar Warraish, your final comment today as these developments continue.
Well, it seems troubling from President Bush's statements that there is no reflective moment being taken at this stage. What I'm particularly concerned about is the attacks that may follow on the huge Muslim community that exists here in Britain. Following September 11th, civil liberties were curtailed to a great extent. People were arrested. Stop and searches went up 300% within that community. Let's hope that racial profiling does not exacerbate further. And as Mr. Ben said, this is a result of the Iraq War and Britain's participation in it.
And Tony Benn.
Well, it is a product of the war. I think of everyone killed everywhere as a product of the war. Every Palestinian, every Israeli, every Iraqi, every Afghan, every American, every Spaniard, every Briton is a victim of the war. And I suppose our immediate concern is to protect London. Obviously, that's our thought, to look after the people who've been injured and the bereaved. But you do have to think about this. And when I hear the President and the Prime Minister saying, we'll beat them, they're full of hate, and we are not, and we're killing people there, I think it will inevitably lead people to think and ask, is there another way forward? And I was with Scott Ritter last night, whom you'll know very well, talking about the decent Americans who are really concerned and worried about what's happening. And with the casualties, you're suffering enormous, what is it, 1750 servicemen and women killed and 8,000, 7,000 or 8,000 injured, bound to consider this and to ask, is this the only way? Is it really necessary that we should continue as if there's no alternative? What is the alternative? What could you do? Are there injustices that, if they were resolved, might ease the tension? But the tragedy is innocent people are killed, and that is people's first concern. But I feel the same for people bombed in Baghdad as I do in London or New York. I'm bound to.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Tony Benn, former British MP, speaking to us from Britain, and Omar Wareish, independent journalist from London, where the bomb blasts or where the blasts have taken place. Again, waiting for full explanation of that. And as that situation continues to unfold in Britain, BBC reporting 2 people confirmed dead, the Sydney Morning Herald reporting 12 people confirmed dead, these developments will continue, more than 100 injured. We're going to turn to a story here at home, and it is the one of the New York Times reporter Judith Miller being sent to jail yesterday after a federal judge declared she was, quote, defying the law for refusing to divulge the name of a confidential source. Miller, along with Matthew Cooper of Time magazine, had been refusing to reveal their confidential sources in the outing of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. Cooper was spared jail time after agreeing to testify just yesterday in the investigation.
That source gave me a personal, unambiguous, uncoerced waiver to speak to the grand jury. And it was only then, when I was satisfied that that source was comfortable with me speaking and indeed wanted me to speak to the grand jury, that I felt free, after 2 years under threat of jail, to go speak to the grand jury.
Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan ordered Miller sent to, quote, a suitable jail within the metropolitan area of the District of Columbia until she decided to talk or until the term of the grand jury expired in October. Matthew Cooper spoke to reporters outside the courthouse after Miller was taken into custody.
Judy is an honorable woman, adhering to the highest tradition of her profession and the highest tradition of humanity. She has chosen, at no benefit to herself and with no desire to be imprisoned, a choice which is to take the burdens, the personal burdens, of being in jail rather than to betray a source to whom she promised confidentiality. She should be honored for that, and I think in history she will be.
Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. Before being taken into custody by 3 court officers, Miller told the judge, quote, if journalists cannot be trusted to guarantee confidentiality, then journalists cannot function and there cannot be a free press. This is Miller's lawyer, Floyd Abrams.
This is a sad day for not only for journalists, for our country. It is a sad time when two journalists who were simply doing their jobs and trying to keep confidences and report important stories face the prospect of going to prison for keeping those confidences. It was a very sad day. My heart goes out to Judy. I told her she left the court to stay strong.
That was Floyd Abrams, the well-known free speech attorney, defends the press very often in major cases like these. He is New York Times reporter Judith Miller's attorney. After the hearing, Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, said, quote, "The choice Judith Miller made is a brave and principled choice, reflects a valuing of individual conscience that has been part of this country's tradition since its founding." In an editorial today, the New York Times writes, quote, "By accepting her sentence, Ms. Miller bowed to the authority of the court, but she acted in the great tradition of civil disobedience that began with this nation's founding, which holds that the common good is best served in some instances by private citizens who are willing to defy a legal but unjust or unwise order." We are joined in the studio by New York Times op-ed columnist Bob Herbert, who writes a twice-a-week column about politics, urban, and social affairs. He's been with the Times since 1993, and before that with NBC, and before that with the Daily News. His first book, Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, came out in May. Bob Herbert, I wanted to ask you about this piece today in the New York Times about Karl Rove, the top suspect for many people for the last 2 years. The New York Times, quoting a source the paper says has been officially briefed on the case, saying that Matt Cooper's source was indeed Karl Rove, but this detail is buried in the 24th paragraph of the Times lead story. The paper says Cooper's decision to drop his refusal to testify followed discussions Wednesday morning among lawyers representing Cooper and Rove. The independent prosecutor, Peter Fitzgerald, was also involved in these discussions. Your response?
Well, the longer I stay in this business, the more I feel like I'm in Never Never Land. Stories used to be reasonably easy to cover. First, thanks for having me on the show this morning. I really appreciate it. But, you know, you look at this, and this is a problem that was created by the administration. The identity of this woman was disclosed. Robert Novak wrote a column about it. Matthew Cooper wrote a story about it. Judith Miller never wrote about it. And it's Judith Miller who's now gone to jail. What is going on here? What's wrong with this picture? It's craziness. Judy had no option. That's exactly what she needed to do. Nobody wants to go to jail, but, you know, we're all journalists around this table, and you understand that it's as simple as if you give your word, you have to keep your word. And if you start betraying sources, you can no longer function in this business. Another thing is, when you work for an organization like the New York Times or any large organization, you know, you're annoyed by this, you're annoyed by that, you complain. You know, it's sort of like the nature of humanity. But I must say that the way the Times has handled this and the way Judy Miller has behaved is a case where it makes you really proud to be part of an organization. I think the New York Times is standing really tall today.
In contrast, you have the reality of Time magazine bowing to the court decision and turning over the notes of its reporter, and of course you have the glaring reality that Novak, the columnist at the center of the whole thing, continues to remain silent, show no kind of solidarity for Judith Miller, no matter what he may think of her reporting or her positions. His willingness just to remain completely silent is something that is just astounding.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I would expect Novak to step forward and do at least what I would perceive to be the right thing. But it is astounding in the community of journalism that you would have someone who essentially is responsible for the story. I mean, it was his story. And, you know, the fallout falls on everybody else. I mean, somebody used the term collateral damage, and that's exactly what this is like. It's bizarre.
I wanted to get your comment, Bob Herbert, on the comment of a guest we had on a little while ago on June 28th. We had Jim Noricus of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Mm-hmm. And we were dealing with the whole issue of, is this about protecting whistleblowers or shielding government wrongdoing? Judith Miller, the national security correspondent, has long done front page pieces alleging weapons of mass destruction using anonymous sources. You, on the other side of the A section, on the op-ed page, have been quite critical of the invasion of Iraq. But I wanted to get your comment on Jim Narikas's feeling about what Judith Miller did.
Anonymous sources can be very important in revealing government wrongdoing. But in this case, the anonymous source is a government wrongdoer. This is someone who's presumably acting on behalf of the administration to silence an administration critic. And to say that the reporters who've witnessed this crime have an absolute right not to testify about it is to say that the government has an absolute right to reveal any confidential information that the government has about individuals in order to punish those individuals for speaking out against the government. And that's just that's a sweeping power that I think it would be very dangerous to give the government.
That's Jim Narikas of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Comment. A couple points. As a reporter, and in many ways an old-fashioned reporter that takes the pen and the notebook and goes out there and covers stories, there is a simple way of looking at this, and it's what I said before. It's this: if you give your word, you have an obligation to keep your word. If you tell somebody for whatever reason that you want them to talk to you, you want them to give you information, and you are not going to disclose their identity, then that's what's absolute in this case. You cannot go back on your word. The second part, which is more complex, is his point about whether there's a claim that she has an absolute right not to identify her source. I don't think journalists are saying that they have an absolute right in all cases not to identify their sources. I think what journalists are saying, or the ones who are going to stand tall, is that they will not identify their sources. It's almost like civil disobedience. So this has gone through the courts. It's gone up to the Supreme Court. The New York Times and Judith Miller were on the wrong side of the decision. And so she's gone to jail. It's not that she's claiming an absolute right to anything. It's that she's asserting that she will not disclose her source.
But the idea that anonymous sources are there for to protect whistleblowers, people who could lose their jobs, people in other countries or perhaps here who feel that their families are threatened, and that what the major press has done in the lead up to the invasion and the coverage of the occupation, and particularly the New York Times and particularly Judith Miller's national security correspondent, I mean, the Times had their own basically mea culpa on page A10 that identified many of the stories, was use anonymous sources, not whistleblowers, but just covering the identities of government officials who were lying and wanted to put forward their argument about weapons of mass destruction that turned out not to be true.
Well, in the first place, I don't see a reporter's assertion of the need to keep sources confidential as limited to whistleblowers. I mean, I have used confidential sources. I try to use them sparingly, but I've used confidential sources in cases where they were not whistleblowers. I mean, you can offer confidentiality for any reason you want. I frequently, reporters use confidentiality in strictly political cases. I mean, there may be a political campaign and somebody says, yeah, hey, you know, so-and-so has been doing this, and you go back and check it and it turns out to be true, but you don't want to reveal who initially tipped you off to it. That's a confidential source, and you don't disclose that source. The other thing is, I don't think the issue of the type of stories that Judy Miller was doing is what's significant here. You can agree or disagree with some of Judy Miller's stories, but the fundamental issue here is whether you're going to betray a trust or not. And as far as I'm concerned, you cannot betray a trust. By the way, I don't consider that limited to journalism. I think it's incredibly important in journalism and beneficial to the journalism community, but also to Americans as a whole. I mean, that's the fundamental issue there. But I feel the same way in any other realm of life. You don't betray your sources.
And we only have about a minute left, but I'd just like to ask you, in terms of your book, Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, a collection of columns, you've been called the conscience of the New York Times. And I know we worked together many years ago, but being at the Times, how has it been trying to maintain a progressive voice within what is essentially has been a centrist editorial page for many years?
And you have 10 seconds for that answer.
It's been easy. I mean, the wonderful part of working on the op-ed page is the freedom that they allow you. I mean, you cover what you want, and your opinions are your own, and they do not interfere with you.
Bob Herbert, we have to have you back. We certainly didn't plan on the latest developments in Britain. I want to thank you for being with us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shroof of Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.